This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with labor attorney Lester Pines about the recent uprisings in Wisconsin.
Hear what's really at stake. Hear how the governor is trying to destroy organized labor in Wisconsin.
For more than a year in Puerto Rico, people have been taking to the streets by the thousands to protest public layoffs and a trend toward privatization.
But you don't hear much about it in the United States. Today you will.
Stay with us.
In these updates, we've been covering the Middle East in particular, and today I want to ask you something about Tunisia. That's been a little out of the news, but I understand that the National Lawyers Guild is sending some lawyers to Tunisia. They need lawyers already?
Well, actually, a couple of our guild attorneys have been invited by the Tunisian National Bar Association to visit from March 12th to 19th and to investigate human rights abuses committed during the Ben Ali regime, and also to look into U.S. and European complicity in such abuses.
What kind of abuses are we talking about?
There have been serious abuses such as torture, arbitrary detention, and the Guild has had success over the last several decades, actually, in sending delegations to Gaza and other places to investigate and document and come up with a report of their firsthand observations.
Well, that's great that they're doing it. You can imagine, as these dictators get stripped of power, what kind of human rights and secret jails and torture equipment they're going to find. They're already finding some in Egypt.
Look what they found in Egypt. They raided the headquarters of the national security apparatus.
There's apparently thousands of pages up on the web, mostly in Arabic.
Yeah, a lot of them up in smoke. The bad guys burned them before they could get there.
But speaking of the Middle East and this delegation, I've been thinking about Libya a lot and been reading a lot in the Times. And the question that in an article in the last couple of days has said, you know, there's political and tactical considerations about intervening in Libya. And I wrote a letter, which normally the Times prints a lot of my letters, but they didn't print this one. And I said, well, you know, there may be tactical and political considerations, but there's also legal ones. The only way a country is allowed to intervene, essentially an act of aggression against another country, is if the Security Council asks them to, basically, if the Security Council approves it under Chapter 7, or it's self-defense, obviously. But in this case, it would be completely unlawful for the U.S. to do it alone, for Europe to do it, or for NATO. I mean, there's always the excuse, well, NATO can do it, even if the U.N. didn't approve it. Not true. You have to have the Security Council to intervene. So all this talk about intervention is just like, it's garbage. I mean, they might violate the law. But it also made me think, not only is it garbage from a legal point of view, they need the Security Council. Think about it from a hypocritical point of view. Right now, going on in Africa, we not only have what's going on in the Congo, but we have the Ivory Coast. The Ivory Coast is as close to a civil war as you're getting. Apparently, an illegitimate man is running the country. He lost the election, but he's continuing to kill people. Hundreds have been killed in the Ivory Coast. You don't see any cries, any front page article about let's intervene in the Ivory Coast. What's the difference between the Ivory Coast and Libya?
Oil.
Oil. One country has oil. The other country has coca.
Supplies the oil to Italy, France, and Germany.
Right. I mean, Ivory Coast doesn't have any oil.
We have nothing to gain.
So if you ask yourself, why are they talking about intervention, quote, humanitarian intervention in Libya? And there's no such doctrine. I mean, there's a doctrine, but there's no legal support for humanitarian intervention, because what happens is it's completely misused. It's done arbitrarily. It's done really in the net, not arbitrarily. It's done in the security interests of the country that wants the oil or what other resources or the strategic position.
The self-interest of the country.
Or, Michael, you wrote something that I thought was excellent with respect to Gaza, when the United States sat on its hands as the Israelis killed 1,400
Similar
people
kind
in
of
Gaza.
Thing. 1,400 people slaughtered in Gaza, and the Security Council doesn't do anything. No country moves a finger to help the Gazans and to punish Israel. So we're talking about the worst kind of hypocrisy. But in some way, it's to be expected. This is about oil. That's what it's about. When you see Ivory Coast going on and Libya going on, you know what's going on.
Oil and empire. Michael, it's been a while since we've had an update on Guantanamo. What's happening?
Well, this week there was a huge amount happening. President Obama, under his signature, entered a number of executive orders with various provisions that essentially make Guantanamo a permanent part of our landscape, make preventive detention a permanent part of our landscape.
And military commissions.
And make military commissions a permanent part of our landscape. Let me just tell our listeners what we have at Guantanamo right now. There were 242 detainees at Guantanamo when Obama took office. By the time Obama took office, President Bush had freed or transferred 500. So when Obama takes office, there's 242. 67 of those 242 have been transferred to other countries. Two have died, and one, Gilani, was the man sent to New York who was convicted of one count at the trial in New York. So of the 67, there's 67 transferred, two have died, and one sent to New York. So you take the 242, you subtract the 70 that I just described, and you have 172 people currently at Guantanamo. So remember that. We have 172 people. They fall into three categories. To me, the most outrageous category is there's 89 people who've been approved to get out of Guantanamo, that they have no reason to be in Guantanamo. They aren't guilty of anything. They should be transferred. So, but they're there. And it always reminds me of, I know all of us have done cases, when someone's held in jail for one extra day, we file a writ of habeas corpus and get them out. Well, these people may have writs of habeas corpus that the judge say they should get out, but the Obama administration isn't letting them out. So you have 89 people there.
But is that because they don't know where to send them?
Well, that's what they would claim. They were chicken to send them to the United States initially. I'll talk about that in a second. 58 of the 89 are from Yemen. And the Obama administration, because they claim it's a disintegrating country, refused to send the 58 to Yemen, even though they're completely innocent. So it's inexcusable. Essentially, for U.S. broad interest of some sort, they're not willing to send the 58 to Yemen, but they're willing to keep them in jail at Guantanamo. I mean, it's completely inhuman. So of the 58, they're Yemeni. They haven't found another home for them. They're there. And, of course, the remainder of the 89 are just sitting there while they're looking for countries. So you have 89 people completely innocent. As I said, if we have one person in New York, I remember during the Republican National Convention, you know, you guys, the Guild, you know, et cetera, Margie, Ratner, Kunstler, you know, filed habeas corpus petitions to get those people out of the Guantanamo on the Hudson.
And why isn't anyone filing those?
Well, of course we did, but the judges, even though habeas is supposed to give you the right to relief by getting you out of prison, because that's the core of what it means to go to court, I'm being imprisoned wrongly. The Obama administration says even if a judge decides the person should be released, that's a matter of foreign national security, and we're not letting them. So let's go back to this. 172 detainees at Guantanamo, 89 completely innocent. Nothing. They shouldn't be there, or at least they've been found to be no reason to continue to hold them. Of the remainders, 47 are now slated and have been slated for what's called indefinite detention, preventive detention. That means they're never going to have a trial. That means they're just there essentially forever. And what Obama did was he issued an order with regard to those 47. The executive order on those 47 does something that is really crossing the Rubicon that even Bush didn't cross. They were held, yes, in indefinite detention under Bush, but they were held because they were associated with Al-Qaeda or had some kind of action with Al-Qaeda or something, supposedly. What the Obama order does is it basically says they can be held unless it's determined that they're no longer dangerous to the national security of the United States. So think about that. That's saying that we are predicating people being held on the fact that they're dangerous to the national security of the United States, even though they've never been tried for a crime. That's classic preventive detention. So we now have a worse scheme under Obama than we had under President Bush, because he's saying, I can keep these people detained just because we think they might be dangerous in the future, not because of the acts they did in the past.
Now, Michael, what kind of legal challenges exist when an executive order is signed? That's the final law?
Well, we go to court, obviously, and we represent, or co-counsel of the centers represent, some of these 47 who are indefinitely detained. And they'll go to court and they'll challenge this idea that you can hold people on the grounds that they're going to do something bad in the future. But just remember, this is crossing the Rubicon. This is preventive detention.
Yeah, because the government's response to that when you do go to court is, A, we're the executive branch. We make the decisions on national security, not the rest of you. B, in the order is that the military is going to review every 4 years the status of these people, and we'll think about it 4 years from now, so goodbye.
Right. Well, let's talk about the review for a second. Some people are like this order a little bit because they said, look, we may not like preventive detention. Some people like it, some people don't, but certainly within a lawyer's group, most people think this is crazy. preventive detention. So what they set up was, basically think of Christmas tree with lots of ornaments or bells and whistles. So they put a lot of bells and whistles on the preventive detention. And as Michael said, they have to have, within 1 year from now, they have to have a review with it. It's called a periodic review panel to look at whether the people will be a danger in the future to the national security. That's 1 year from now.
But so, that's secret, isn't it?
No, that will actually be, part of it will be secret, okay. But they will be allowed to have, for the first time, a lawyer with them if they can afford to get a lawyer or part of our team represents them, does it for pro bono. So they will be able to go through a periodic review, but it's of a preventive detention scheme in which future dangerousness is the criteria. That will be 1 year from now is when they have to have those hearings. So the people are there for another year. Then after that, if they're upheld to have preventive detention, then there's going to be a hearing. Michael said 4 years, but it's 4 years from now, but it's every 3 years after that. So you basically have people will be spending the rest of their lives in prison at Guantanamo in preventive detention, never having been convicted of a crime. I mean, it's stunning. It's just stunning. And that's just the 47 people who are being preventively detained. Then, as I said, there's 47 indefinite detention, preventively detained, 89 approved for transfer. That leaves us with 36 people who have been, quote, referred for prosecution. They haven't been charged, but they've been referred for prosecution. What does Obama say now in the order? We are now going to go back to military commissions. Yeah. And yes, I'll make a choice of whether to try these people in federal court or in military commissions. But so far, he's had 2 years, and he's only tried one person in a federal court. So these 36 people, most of them, assuming they're charged, are going to, or just kept indefinitely, but assuming they're charged, will be tried by the rump tribunals of military commissions, which are completely illegal under international law. Completely. Geneva Conventions says you can't have ex post facto prosecutions. You can't do it. Done. You can't do it. And that's what they're doing. So this order is an outrage. Now, one of the excuses you see is Obama had his hands tied because, you know, the Congress right now has actually passed laws saying no Guantanamo people can be brought to the United States, even for trial. You know, they've been going after him. But we discussed this a lot within our legal team. And of course, what the legal team and others point out is from the beginning, even though Obama said he wanted to close Guantanamo, he caved from the very beginning. The first people when he took office were the Uyghurs, which were from Western China. They were completely innocent. There was an order to bring them in the United States, a big Uyghur community in Washington, and Obama basically said, I'm not bringing them in. And he's also continued to allow the Justice Department to defend every one of these cases and these incarcerations. He didn't have to do it. Then, as I mentioned, he stopped the transfer of anybody to Yemen, and he's essentially caved in to the national security establishment and therefore giving Congress an opening that it took. So he's just been a complete, not just a weakling, that's not bad enough. He's basically given us our first real preventive detention scheme based on future conduct that we've ever had in the United States.
Michael, I wonder if because so many of the detainees were released, that the public isn't really up in arms in reaction to this because it's a smaller group?
You know, I think it's a very good question, Heidi. You know, I say to myself, how do you beat this? I mean, where's the public support for closing Guantanamo? At least under Bush, the liberals went crazy about Guantanamo. Now under Obama, they go less crazy. And the problem is, when Obama is given this kind of, I mean, he may really believe all this stuff, probably does, but when he's given a decision and they say, this is going to, what are you bothering with here? You have the CIA against you, the military against you, and you're going to hurt your election chances because you're going to be looking at Democrats soft on terrorism, he just caves immediately. Now, I doubt he'll hurt his election chances. Had he been strong from the beginning, we wouldn't have Guantanamo right here. But the question is, what's the constituency out there as a civil libertarian, as a person who cares about Guantanamo? How do you change it? Not so easy right now.
Well, I think if I were talking about it, I'd make the connections between Egypt and Wisconsin and the arbitrary authority of the government to crush popular protest and say that this is the kind of thing that can come home. And that way we have to be vigilant about it in Guantanamo, looking into the future and protecting ourselves here. Founding fathers are vigilant about it. That's why we have the laws we have, including habeas. And any erosion in Guantanamo is ultimately an erosion here.
No, I think that's right, Michael. I think the fact that we have set up a preventive detention scheme based on future possible harm to the United States doesn't mean it can just be applied to people at Guantanamo. I mean, he may try and restrict it in the order, but it's an example and it's a precedent that it's extremely dangerous, extremely. I mean, I remember, you know, this is all, it'll be 10 years this September when really 9/11. And the center and I started these cases in November after the first executive order came down to start Guantanamo and start these detention without trial scheme. And, you know, I remember at the time, none of us could believe it. We were so shocked by the Bush order that you could pick up any person anywhere in the world and hold them without a trial, hold them without habeas, and hold them in an offshore facility and preventively detain them and try them by military commission if you try them. No one could believe it. And yes, we won the right of habeas for them, but if the habeas judge can't release them, it's not exactly a lot of good. And so it's no good because you keep them at Guantanamo. What we have now is 10 years later, almost 10 years later, we have the tentacles of that policy getting deeper and deeper embedded into the constitutional structure of the United States, and that's a disaster.
I remember when you wrote that article, Michael, and I remember Daniel Ellsberg said what you said. Clark Kissinger called it a rolling coup. You said, in retrospect, that's when the coup happened. That so enshrined executive authority that it was horrific, and it's still there.
Organized labor is one of the last targets to be taken down by corporate America. Last month, thousands of people continued a multi-week occupation of the Wisconsin State Capitol building, while some 150,000 gathered in the snow on the last weekend in February, chanting outside of the Capitol building. The country is gripped by the drama unfolding in Wisconsin, and it has inspired unions and other states to move in solidarity. Amongst those states are Montana, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Wisconsin trade unions have already conceded to wage and benefit cuts, but legislation in Wisconsin and many other states is aimed right at the heart of the existence of these unions, that is, to their right to collective bargain. We're joined today by Wisconsin labor attorney Lester Pines for an update and to discuss what's at stake for organized labor. Attorney Lester Pines, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Lester, what kind of law do you practice in Madison?
Well, I do a broad civil trial practice and criminal defense work, which I've done that practice for, I mean, now in my 37th year. I'm also counsel to Madison Teachers Incorporated, which is the union that represents employees of the Madison Metropolitan School District. And my firm represents a few other public employee labor unions. So we do a very broad practice. We have had an emphasis over the years on labor and employment as part of our civil practice.
You certainly then have a good perspective on what's going on. What's your take? What do you think's at stake here in this showdown between Governor Scott Walker and the rest of the state of Wisconsin?
A number of things are at stake, and we can look at it on the state level. We can look at it on the national level. Governor Walker is clearly a stalking horse for the far right wing of the Republican Party. I actually was not surprised at his behavior. He behaved this way when he was a Milwaukee County executive. I told people immediately after he was elected, in fact, I told people during the election that he was going to try to repeal Chapter 1170, which is the public employee bargaining chapter. So I wasn't surprised at all about his behavior. What's at stake is in Wisconsin is an attempt by the governor and really by the legislature. It's not just the governor, it's the legislature as well, to really strike at the heart of the Wisconsin tradition of organized labor. I mean, this is a heavily unionized state. Union membership has dropped as manufacturing has fallen off, but it's still more heavily unionized than most states. Most families in Wisconsin, or many families in Wisconsin, have union members or come from union parents. So that's a very deep part of the state. And public employee bargaining in Wisconsin has been in existence for 50 years, and really in the last 35 years has become standard and become standardized. That is, labor relations between municipal employers, which includes school districts, have become very peaceful, and the municipalities, school districts actually rely on the union contracts for an organized way of dealing with employees. So this is an attempt to really tear apart generations of how Wisconsin has operated. And on a national level, I mean, I'm probably not telling you and the listeners things that they don't already know, but this is a very clear attempt to destroy public employee unions and essentially wipe away the last vestige of outside groups that fund Democratic and progressive candidates. The field will be completely occupied by corporate donors.
Can you just bring us up to date? Where is the legislation right now? What are its key provisions? And what do you expect? I mean, maybe it's too hard to say what do you expect, but some of the key provisions that are really pernicious, as well as where does it actually stand?
The legislation is part of what was called a budget repair bill. Wisconsin has a biennial budget, and the current budget runs through June 30 of this year. The legislature will frequently, during the two-year budget, take steps to adjust the budget as need be. So this initial matter is a budget, what's called a budget repair bill or a budget alteration bill. Within that bill is a provision to effectively eliminate collective bargaining for all municipal and school district employees, as well as for state employees.
What does that mean, to eliminate collective bargaining? I understand that what happens when a contract expires, the union rep and the management, they meet and they discuss what should be our pensions, what should be our wages. And so if you eliminate that, what do you have? I don't understand.
There will be no bargaining. That is, that the only issues on which there can be bargaining and the only thing on which there can be a contract, if this bill passes, is wages. But the bill also imposes a cap on wages at the cost of living, and also provides that if a municipality or school district wants to exceed the cap, that has to go to referendum. No other provisions of the collective bargaining agreement may be bargained.
Give us some examples of those.
Grievance procedure, layoff with regard to teachers, class size, early retirement incentives, a whole variety of things, safety issues, overtime issues, work assignment issues, nothing.
So those factors could, some of those elements could be removed, such as overtime provisions, and the workers have no say.
That's right.
Attorney Lester Pines, you're a labor lawyer in Madison, Wisconsin. Governor Walker is also trying to end the dues checkoff system and call for elections every year. I mean, it really pulls the rug out from under a union.
Absolutely. I was about to get to that. Those are among the most pernicious of the provisions. The dues checkoff provision requiring a union to be recertified every year. These are designed to essentially make it impossible for public employee unions to function in any meaningful way. Also, eliminating fair share. So those three provisions, recertification on a yearly basis, no dues checkoff, and no fair share.
What's fair share?
Fair share is where an individual does not want to be a member of the union but has to contribute that portion of the union dues which the union uses to enforce the collective bargaining.
So it's a right-to-work provision.
It's a right-to-work provision. It's been in the law in Wisconsin for many, many years, and fair share has been generally a very, very high percentage of union dues. So it really hasn't been a problem, and most people join the union. There really aren't that many people who don't join. So the combination of essentially eliminating the ability to negotiate about workplace issues, workplace conditions, and limiting pay increases to the cost of living, eliminating the right to negotiate over health benefits and putting everyone into the state insurance pool, all of these things essentially make it really impossible. In combination with the no dues checkoff, no fair share, and recertification on a yearly basis, it's essentially destroying public employee unions without repealing the entire process for having public employee unions. Couldn't be worse.
Attorney Lester Pines, let me ask you this. This is reminiscent of Thomas Frank's book, What Happened in Kansas, about he writes about how people vote in a certain way, and it's really against their best interests. And in Wisconsin, I mean, their state is full of working people. Nevertheless, they elected Scott Walker. Was it a fact that he didn't talk about what he was going to actually do? And how do people feel about Walker now?
Well, number one, he didn't talk about what he would actually do. Number two, if we look at the vast number of people who have been demonstrating in Madison, these are the biggest demonstrations I've ever seen here. I was here during the height of the anti-war movement, when Madison was really one of the epicenters of that movement. The demonstrations here are far larger than any anti-war demonstration ever was.
Amazing. It's great.
And the polls, you know, Scott Walker's poll numbers have dropped precipitously. And most people during the election, I would say, paid not very close attention to it. The Democratic candidate, Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, ran a fairly weak race, and the Democratic turnout was somewhat lower than normal, and that's what led to Scott Walker being elected.
And the right wing financed him. We should mention that.
Yeah, the right wing financed him. Both races were well financed. It isn't like Tom Barrett didn't have money to run an effective race, but the fact of the matter is people elected this guy without really knowing what he was about, and the message about what he was about wasn't adequately communicated. People voted for him, and here we are. Now people are stuck. Now, if the election was held today, he would lose, that's for sure, but it's a little bit late.
Well, let's talk about something other than an election. I saw a photograph of my sister, Patty Elson, carrying a sign in front of the Capitol building that said, "Impeach the heartless bastard." Is that a possibility?
Yeah. Impeachment isn't a possibility because the Republicans control the legislature, the Assembly, and the Senate. However, can be recalled. That process cannot start until January 3rd, 2012. By then, a lot of damage will have been done. Well,
so how do you expect this legislation to be resolved? I mean, what do you think is going to happen here? There's still people protesting, I assume. I know the Senate, which was the one that has, I guess, enough, which is the one, one of the houses, the Senate has enough votes. They passed part of it. It's the House, yeah. I think, that's they need a Democrat to get there. The Democrats are out of state. What's going to happen?
Well, actually, it's the Senate.
It's the Senate, okay.
And they don't have a quorum in the Senate because they need 20. The Republicans only have 19. All the Democrats have left the state, and they're in Illinois. I call it the free territory of Wisconsin.
It's unbelievable.
They can't stay away forever. It's a tremendous burden on them. They're doing a terrific job. They've stayed away for a couple of weeks already.
If they come into their state, what do? They arrest them and take them to the chamber? What happens?
It's somewhat unclear whether or not any police agency has the authority to do that, and because of the lack of clarity, they can't be arrested in a criminal sense, but the Senate can do what's called a call of the Senate, and then there could be a civil process, what would be called a body attachment, and they can be brought back to the chamber, in theory.
What a scandal that would be.
Yeah, it really would be a scandal. I mean, there's some negotiation going on between the senators in Illinois and some of the Republican senators. I'm not privy to that, and I don't know how it's going to turn out. I mean, but I will say this, that I think most people know that the senators can't stay away forever. And Scott Walker, by doing this, has reignited the progressive movement in Wisconsin. You can't have people participate in demonstrations like this and in discussions like this and in email and texting and social networking and not be fired up. And I have to tell you that at least in Madison, after the election of Scott Walker and after the legislature turned over completely to the Republicans, people in Madison felt, I think, like the Parisians felt after the Germans occupied France, when the French army collapsed so quickly. I mean, people here were completely demoralized and numb, didn't really know what to do. The one thing Scott Walker has done is he has reignited people's passion for politics in the state. I think the long-term harm is going to be to the Republicans and to the really hard right Republicans. But the problem is before you can get them out of office, they're going to do a tremendous amount of damage because they're actually nihilists. They're not they care nothing for public service. They care nothing for public services. They care only about doing what their corporate puppeteers want them to do.
A law at least related to the law that the governor is trying to get through in Wisconsin. Apparently some of that law went through in Indiana. They're looking at a law like that in Ohio. Are you knowledgeable about what's going on in some of those core states where they're looking at the same kind of law for public unions?
Yeah, I'm not. It looks like that this whole anti-public union movement was actually planned out amongst all these new governors. And I think that the reaction in Wisconsin has slowed down the process in other states. And so, you know, we hope that that's the case. It seems like that's the case. Not every governor is as rigid, as ideologically rigid as Scott Walker is.
I got a note from a couple friends in Madison that said, they're asking for some legal help and stuff like that, but they said they just entered a temporary restraining order, the court did. Now, what was that? Was that about demonstrating, or what is that, and what's the status of that?
It was access to the Capitol, which has been severely restricted. There was a restraining order that directed the state to allow access to the Capitol. Unfortunately, the restraining order was not broad enough to really deal with the problem. There's an ongoing hearing now on a temporary injunction, and we don't know how that's going to turn out. Strategically, there were things that were done in the case from the plaintiff's side which were less than optimal.
So are there still people out there today at the state capitol?
Well, my office overlooks the capitol. There aren't many people out today, but there will be many people out again this weekend for sure. People are not going to go away.
Well, all of our listeners and our hosts who've been to Madison, it's a very bucolic setting out there where you're looking over. Lots of grass around the Capitol. You know, a farmer's market on Saturday, and I guess a big change.
Yeah, well, right now there's snow on the Capitol crowd.
Oh, okay.
You know, you have to admire the people who are out on Saturday. It was 15 degrees and it was snowing. And
wow,
there were 100,000 people.
On Wisconsin, Attorney Lester Pines, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We're going to be checking in with you later on, so keep your antenna up.
Great. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder, we interviewed attorney Judy Birkin, who practices in Puerto Rico, about the 100,000 people who took to the streets of San Juan to protest the layoff of about 17,000 public employees. We interview Judy again today as an update on the neoliberal attack, not only on public employees in Puerto Rico, but on the university and especially on the Bar Association. Judith Birkin is a partner in the San Juan law firm of Birkin Mendez. She specializes in government misconduct litigation and in employment discrimination cases. Birkin worked as an attorney in New Haven, Connecticut, before going to Puerto Rico some 30 years ago as a staff attorney for the Puerto Rican Legal Project of the National Lawyers Guild, now called the Puerto Rican Civil Rights Institute.
Judy Birkin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be here, Heidi.
Hard to believe it's been a year since we've last spoken to you. And since then, there's been so much happening in Puerto Rico. Could you tell us what you think is the biggest development lately?
It's been a very busy year.
Seems like a roller coaster year, but go ahead.
Yeah, and pretty devastating for the state of affairs here. First of all, the economic policies that I spoke of a year ago have remained in effect and have become even more draconian as the government has continued to lay off people and also to take a series of measures to eliminate the rights of workers, to abrogate collective bargaining agreements, and a number of other measures which make it very hard on all but a few who have the means to survive in the economic situation we're facing. But I would say that the most dramatic things in the last year have been, one, the University of Puerto Rico and the strike there, which has economic facets and also really major significance in terms of the future of the university and of the country. And secondly, the wholesale attack on institutions of Puerto Rican society where any dissent could be lodged. And, of course, really direct attacks on those who dare to dissent here. It's been a really qualitatively different time than other times that I've been here 35 years.
So. Attorney Judy Birkin, tell us specifically what the attacks have been on the Bar Association.
All right. The Bar Association is one of those institutions, and perhaps the most important institution, which serves as a real forum for the rights of people who otherwise don't have voice in this society. Up until November of 2009, it was a mandatory bar association following the tradition basically in all of Latin American countries and most of Europe. The attacks have come through legislation in that period of time, in which the legislature of Puerto Rico eliminated mandatory bar membership and also imposed a series of draconian restrictions on the Bar Association, with the most dramatic of which is that we were prohibited from making any public statements of political or religious nature of any kind. They took away a great deal of our funding. They took away the, I say our, because I identify with the Colegio and I've been its attorney for a long time as well. They took away the powers to review judgeships and a number of other matters. But in recent months, these legislative attacks have been combined with a longstanding lawsuit which questioned by really people who have very little to do with the practice of law in the courts of Puerto Rico. And they questioned the provision of a life insurance policy, which was really a policy aimed to provide minimum coverage for the widows and widowers of poorer lawyers, frankly. They questioned that, and there's a federal court determination that that provision of insurance was illegal. They converted it into a class action, though none of us as class action members were informed of this in violation of all applicable rules. And then the federal court gave a 30-day period for opt-outs, those of us who do not want to be part of that class, to submit our forms. The Bar Association president, Osvaldo Toledo, was prohibited from making any public statements or informing the membership of their right to opt out of this, frankly, attacking lawsuit, to not give it a different word, by these people who have gone through many, many attempts to destroy the Bar Association. And once he did speak out, he was jailed for 5 days in contempt late last month.
That's amazing. The president of the Bar Association was jailed, right?
The president of the Bar Association was jailed for 5 months for talking to the membership.
5 days, right? 5 days.
For 5 days. Yep. He had some health issues. It would have been a month, but he had to come out. Combined with a number of other attacks on First Amendment freedoms here, which have been just extraordinary, including a one-month prohibition of all leafleting and public expression in the university. People were arrested for handing out leaflets. The designation of free speech areas, which are like 20 by 10, where you're allowed to speak.
They do here.
The closing of the legislative chambers, we were not allowed to go, and when we protested it, we were met by tear gas and, I mean, scenes of the Middle East you see every day on the news here. And you know, it's very frustrating to us here, since this is a colony of the United States, that this information doesn't get out much to the United States.
No, it doesn't. It gets almost no press here at all. I mean, even people who are, you know, worked in Puerto Rico and others know very little about it.
Judy, I wanted to ask a little more about the police. Is this a marked difference in how the police have treated individuals in the past?
We've had longstanding problems with the police here. I mean, this is a a department in many ways out of control, and I've litigated a lot of cases on behalf of families of people who've been killed by the police officers. Right now, I understand there's a U.S. Department of Justice investigation and some talk of trusteeship of the police department here. But I would say since the new administration came in 2 years ago, the use of the tactical operations units of the police to repress dissent has been much intensified. There have been incidents in the past, but now it's hard to count them. It's something that happens with such frequency that we're sort of getting used to it, which is part of my fear, because if you keep getting used to the use of repressive forces to stifle dissent, people stop dissenting. It has been more intense in the last 2 years.
The ACLU came out with a report, Human Rights Crisis in Puerto Rico, First Amendment Under Siege.
Yes, there's that report, I would commend people to read it. It was also placed into the congressional record last week by Luis Gutierrez, congressman from Illinois. And it really does set forth a lot of these First Amendment issues, which are pretty dramatic. All of our public spaces are being closed off to legitimate dissent.
Oh,
and
now,
people who are engaged in peaceful dissent are being attacked.
I want to hear a little more, Judy, about the university, because we followed it a while ago, and then it got quiet, and then there was, I think, a new chancellor somebody appointed, and then again I read that the new chancellor was, escorted out by the cops the other day. I think it was the other day. Catch, what are the issues? I know there's an issue about privatization and increase in fees, but just give us a sense of what's going on.
In 3 minutes. It's a complex set of issues. There were, as part of the supposed economic, there is an economic crisis, but there are, as part of the remedy for that economic crisis, there was an increase in tuition of $800, which may not sound a lot in the U.S. context, but for families here in Puerto Rico, that was a significant increase. But more than that, there are questions about the vision that the university will take in the future, because it has been a center not only for intellectual thought, but for social, cultural, economic, political planning, thinking, of a formation of professionals in the culture, professionals in this country, and particularly a class equalizer in some ways, because it did allow people who were not from the upper classes to actually get that kind of quality education. And right now, the emphasis appears to be on privatization, as it is throughout the government that's in power right now, on privatization, on the directing of studies towards a really mercantile view of what education should be to suit the needs of industries and the big law firms in the context of the law school where I used to teach until this happened. There have been two strikes. The first one was a lengthy strike, which reached an agreement after really arduous work, and then the government immediately reneged on the agreement when the governor just simply increased the numbers of members of the Board of Trustees. Then there was a decision to bring the police into the campus, and there were some devastating incidents of the police attacking the tactical operations divisions of the police attacking students and professors and parents of students, et cetera. And as I said, students arrested for handing out leaflets. Recently, the president resigned, and the tactical operations units were removed from the university. But just yesterday, there was an incident, or day before yesterday, in which evidently there was violence directed at the chancellor, who is the one who issued the edict that there could be no protests on campus. And she was injured. It's unclear whether this was by provocateurs or by students. And now the new president of the university is talking about bringing the tactical operations forces back in. The underlying issues have not resolved.
Judy, in recounting all this to us, it has a familiar ring, like what's going on in Wisconsin, but steroids in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, no, I truly believe, if you look at Governor Fortuño's program, and Governor Fortuño recently was the guest of the Heritage Foundation and has been mentioned by Grover Norquist as the light of the Hispanic community. Oh, if you look at Governor Fortuño's programs, they are neoliberal programs with respect to economic measures, privatization, cutting of public employees, abrogating collective bargaining agreements, and we've been suffering these programs since basically early 2009, 2 years now. And when I saw Wisconsin and Ohio
and Indiana,
whatever, yeah, I saw that this was going on a couple of weeks ago. I said, well, you know, we were the guinea pigs here. You know, there's more violence associated with it, because if we occupied the state house here, we would have been met with pepper spray and gas and beatings, as we were when we attempted to demonstrate outside the state house once they closed the Capitol building to all visitors and press last June. So, you know, it is a little bit on steroids, as you say, but the economic programs are really the model that's being used, I believe, by some of the right-wing Republican governors in the states.
Judy, are the prisons there privatized?
Some of them are. It's not been a major development here. And a lot of the services, I mean, all the electronic surveillance services and that are privatized.
Judy, you brought us up to date on a number of different areas, the First Amendment, the protests, what's allowed in terms of leafleting, the Bar Association, the university. Give us some sense of what's going to happen in the next half a year. I mean, how much longer is this governor there? How much longer are people going to continue protests, et cetera?
Yeah. The university situation is sort of wallowing in the wind without a real solution, and there's been some dissipation of the unity of the student leadership, which was very impressive, especially in the first strike. So I don't know where that's going in the long run. I think we're headed, unless we can really stop this, where the train is on the road to privatization one way or the other, whether it's through certain programs or just, you know, having all the clinics at the school directed towards industry, science, and all that. The university situation is in flux, and I can't be very optimistic about it. The Bar Association, we have surprised every attacker after they made mandatory membership no longer was in existence. We got 9,000 of the 13,000 lawyers in Puerto Rico to sign up anyway, and that includes a lot of inactive people, the ones who didn't sign up. And on the opt-out, we're doing, we've got more than 50% of the individuals who are only given, you know, 10, 20 days of notice to opt out. And so we're fighting back, and I think the Bar Association is well on its way to surviving this attack, these attacks, and that will be, continue to be a force. You have to understand the significance of the Bar Association, not just as a Bar Association which groups lawyers, but that really their building and their presence is very crucial to public debate in Puerto Rico, and that's one of the reasons we're so sorely under attack. I think people are getting tired. We do have 2 more years left of this administration. In Puerto Rico, unfortunately, elections are every 4 years, and every elective post, municipal, state, governor, every single elective post in Puerto Rico is up for grabs at that time, and I wouldn't hazard a guess as to how people are going to react. We really have been somewhat beaten down, and so hopefully there'll be a little more spirit of resistance in the next period of time. And lastly, I can say as to the police, the rumors about the U.S. justice involvement have been very intense, and there have been some changes made, but the police department is still in the hands of a former FBI agent, Jose Figueroa Sancha, who has openly encouraged violence against protesters. And one of the problems right now, we also have a raging crime rate. And so people are beginning to see the contradiction between, you know, over 250 murders in a small period of time this year in Puerto Rico in 2 months. And we see every day on the news the police being deployed to beat up students. So it's a time of great contradiction, and as it was once said, you know, contradiction is opportunity, so we'll see where it goes.
Judy, I just wanted to ask about the media coverage and how that plays into what's happening.
Well, I mean, I can criticize the media in Puerto Rico because it used to be much more investigative-oriented and all that, but I cannot really say that the media in Puerto Rico doesn't cover these things. I mean, we see these things every day on news reports and in our newspapers, and the media has taken some pretty bad hits. I mean, a bunch of them have been assaulted. Their cameras have been knocked down in the context of these protests. But What's distressing for all of us here who care about these matters is the blackout in the United States. I mean, I think Luis Gutierrez's remarks have helped to get a little bit of the word out, but I'm just really distressed by the fact that, you know, here we are. We are the largest colony of the United States. You know, the U.S. Justice Department directly intervenes here. The federal court is a court. It's an imperial court in many ways, but it's the United States court in Puerto Rico, and even so, the information is not getting out.
You mentioned in passing that you used to teach at University of Puerto Rico Law School and that you no longer do. And I'm just wondering how that came about.
Well, I've been teaching in law schools for the last 35 years, and in the last 5 or 6 years I was teaching con law, police brutality, and employment discrimination at the University of Puerto Rico, and the classes were very good. And I was just informed that I was an adjunct professor and I'm no longer there, and several other progressive professors were also informed that they're no longer there. And what we see happening in the law school context, for example, is people talking about clinics being no longer directed at helping poor communities, but rather, you know, gearing people into the big law firms. We are seeing, you know, the former dean talking about the need for construction law and patent law classes rather than police brutality.
Can you imagine that, a corporate law clinic? It's awful.
And one of the law firms is the main advisors to the university presidency in terms of all their actions against the students and the professors. I saw that myself in the context of the law school where I was. But this is playing out at every sector of the university, where the focus, it's not just about the $800 tuition increase. The focus is, what do we understand the role of the university to be in the society? Is it just are we training people to be managers at McDonald's, or are we training people to think about what's best for the future of Puerto Rico?
It's amazing that they got rid of you and others at the law school. I mean, it just shows how crazy the whole, not crazy, but how they're really after both privatization and corporatization.
Right. And that's why I said the university is sometimes, the struggle is sometimes misfocused when they say it's all about an $800 increase. So it is about that. Yeah. There's much more at stake.
Well, Judy, thank you very, very much. And I know you've been
thank
in Puerto Rico. How many years
me.
Have you been in Puerto Rico, Judy?
34.
All right.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Judy.
You too.
We get an update from Board of Directors member Stanley Aronowitz on the upcoming Spring Left Forum starting March 18th at Pace University. Stanley Aronowitz, you've been a frequent guest on Law and Disorder. We're so happy to have you talk about the upcoming Left Forum starting March 18th at Pace. Give us a little preview about what's going to be happening.
Well, this year's Left Forum is going to be probably the largest Left Forum we've had in its five-year history. We expect 3,500 attendees, which is probably 500 more than were there last year. We've grown every year since 2006. It's going to be large partly because this is a time of extreme struggle. One of the issues that will be addressed at the Left Forum, there'll be a panel on Madison, Wisconsin, for example.
My alma mater.
Your alma mater, right. Many panels on labor, because the labor question is coming before us. The opening plenary will have Cornel West, Barbara Ehrenreich, Laura Flanders, Paul Masson. The closing plenary will have Malalai Joya, John Nichols of The Nation, Carlos M.V., and Luciana Castellina, who's a very prominent independent leftist in Italy. There will be panels on local issues in New York, such as the Bloomberg Mystique, panels on neoliberalism and the struggle against mainstream economic perspectives. There will be panels on climate change. There'll be panels against the death penalty. There'll be panels on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, the regional context of Obama's war. Panels on education.
Stanley, how do people register, and can they register on site?
Yeah, they can register on site, but they can also go to www.leftforum.org. or call 212-817-2003. And you can register online, or you can register on by means of a voicemail.
Pace University is right near City Hall.
It is on the east side of City Hall. It's a group of buildings that's on the other side of the City Hall Park. That is the east side of the City Hall Park.
And if you get in, you'll look upon one of our favorite leftists in New York, Stanley Aronowitz, on the board of directors of the Left Forum. Thanks for bringing us up to date, and we'll see you all starting March 18th. Thank you, Stanley.
Okay, hope to see you, Michael. Bye now.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.